Welcome to Pomegranate Health, a podcast about the culture of medicine. I'm Mick Cavazzini for the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. Most of you listening will know that there are serious gaps between the average health of Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, and that behind this are generations of disadvantage and trauma. Life expectancy for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples is 10 years lower than it is for the rest of the population, and the gap has actually increased since 2008. But targets to reduce child mortality and enrol 4-year-olds in preschool are on track, thanks to some culturally appropriate maternity and early childhood programs. In the spirit of a 2019 report to the Closing the Gap initiative by the Lowitja Institute, I want to focus on promising examples of Indigenous-led intervention like this, and also highlight how health professionals can ally with such programs. The RACP has mapped out a best practice guide for its members called the Medical Specialist Access Framework. It addresses the critical fact that Indigenous Australians receive specialist medical services 40% less than non-Indigenous Australians. It's easy to imagine remote communities out in the desert and blame culture clash or the tyranny of distance. But that's only a fraction of the story. 35% of Australia's Indigenous people live in major cities, and 44% in areas classified as regional. Even if tertiary services are more limited in the country, we heard in episode 48 how there are some very effective models of care. So why aren't specialist services reaching Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? The reason is usually very straightforward, according to Donna Jeffries, Executive Manager of the Maribyrnya Brokerage Service.
For Indigenous people in particular, one of the greatest barriers and challenges is cash. People don't have money. It's a socioeconomic disadvantage. It's, you know, the isolated rural communities, which can be hours away from the nearest service provider. They'll go and see the local GP, that's fine. But if the local GP says, oh, look, you need to probably go and have this test or that test, and if you don't have the money, it's too stressful, you don't know how you're going to get there, you have to organise accommodation when you go, so it's just easier not to go because it's too hard, it's too difficult, and they'll just accept, you know, the cards that have been dealt for them.
The Maribyrnya program is funded through the Western New South Wales Primary Health Network and absorbs some of the financial shock of seeing a specialist. The process starts at the GP consultation. If a patient is diagnosed with a chronic disease, then the doctor can write up a GP management plan. Where multidisciplinary care is required, then a more detailed team care arrangement is sketched out. A patient with type 2 diabetes, for example, may need to see an endocrinologist, a diabetes educator, a podiatrist, and an exercise physiologist. Other conditions Maribyrnya is focused on are cardiovascular disease, cancer, and chronic respiratory or kidney disease. While the GP consults are covered by Medicare, the referrals from then on may have out-of-pocket costs at the clinic and certainly on the road. As you might have heard in episode 48, for serious diagnostic tools and inpatient care, the main referral centres in country New South Wales are Bathurst, Orange and Dubbo. Smaller towns like Bourke or Mudgee host visiting clinics for the most needed specialties, but some patients will be hours away by road regardless. And a few ultimately end up in Sydney for the most serious procedures. If a GP enlists Maribyrnya, within 48 hours staff will be in touch with the client to discuss the appointments they need to make and what help they need to get there. Since the health network covers more than half the state, there is a Maribyrnya staff member drawn from 10 community centres around the region. I met them all at a meeting on Wiradjuri country, in a motel conference room in Dubbo. Unfortunately, there was a road crew working just outside the door.
I'm Desley Mason and I cover the Womble cluster, which is the Dubbo, Wellington and Warren area.
Sandra Ritchie, I'm from Condobolin and I cover condo parks, Forbes Peak.
Possum from Bourke, I cover the Gundabooka cluster, which is Bourke, Cobar.
Kim, I do the Kamilaroi cluster, which is Canamble, Gilgandra, Galar.
Jake and I cover the Nuno cluster, and that consists of Bawarana, Walgett.
My name's Joanne Bagg. The Windradyne cluster, which is Candos, Mudgee.
Melissa Flannery. I do the Garrion cluster. I cover Cowra, Orange.
Do I say hi or just say my name's Gabby Bug? Okay. My name is Gabby Bug. This is my first day with the Maribyrnong team, and I'll be covering Bathurst area.
You'll notice the name, I think everybody introduced the name of the cluster as we went around as well. So they all have Indigenous names which represent either landmarks or tribal groups or great warriors where we operate.
Yeah, just to get that impression of how diverse it is around here. But, so here about 12% of the population is Aboriginal around the Dubbo area. Is that pretty consistent throughout the Central West, or are there towns that have much higher populations?
Some of the rural areas. I know Brewarrina, for example, we have as high as 67% Indigenous population, whereas places like Bourke are around 30, 32%. So it sort of fluctuates a little bit.
See, Gadoogabe, which is my hometown, is about 90% Aboriginal.
Mm-hmm. How big a town is that?
The population is about 250.
Mm-hmm. And now that you've explained where all the regions that you cover, maybe you can explain how you connect with the people through the GP clinics. Is it a kind of a caseworker approach that you sort of really help them along every, you make the phone calls and get an appointment and so on?
Staff do, ring and confirm if a patient's got an appointment with a cardiologist somewhere. We'll ask the specialist rooms if there's a bill associated with the appointment. If there is, we'll say, okay, well, we'll be in charge of that. Can we provide you with a purchase order number? You tell us what it's going to cost and we'll take care of that. So we do all of those negotiations up front, but we don't actually go and make the client's appointment, so we're not doing the care coordination role. We're just sort of brokering the services that they need. Feedback from a lot of our clients with that is that they've actually found that quite empowering, and they're stepping up to the mark and taking more responsibility for their own healthcare and their own health planning, which has been quite a good outcome as well.
Yeah, sort of meeting them halfway. It's like, we'll help you with this if you kind of put the effort in to do that.
Yeah, so our program is specifically designed to make sure that the GP know what's going on and the client know what's going on, and they are the main two people in the driver's seat. The meaning of our name, Maribyrnong, it's like hand outstretched. So you're giving somebody a hand, you're not actually doing stuff for them.
Thanks to having Indigenous staff serving regions they are connected to, Maribyrnong has quickly earned the trust of clients. Long-term relationships are important in small communities, particularly when health professionals themselves often rotate through at a high rate. But Maribyrnong has had to work harder to get the recognition of some GP clinics and providers of specialist services. You'll hear Kim Lees, Joanne Bug, and Sandra Ritchie describe some of these encounters. But first, Melissa Flannery explains what a relief it is for Aboriginal people to be able to turn up to a specialist as a paying client.
Like, they don't feel, oh God, I've got to tell them I can't afford this. They know it's right and they can go. Some of the service providers have been good with the program. A lot will take our purchase orders. You'll get some that refuse, that will say, no, we only want credit card payment. Like, some are really blunt and just refuse. Oh, no, sorry, give me a letter to prove that. That's what I've had. Not very often.
I'd probably say to one specialist here in Dubbo, like, how they used to bulk bill before when we ring up and just confirm an appointment because they hear that Maribyrnong's paying for it. Oh, no, it's $530. So that's the biggest thing. Why were you bulk billing before Maribyrnong come along? They say to me, we only get $91 back from Medicare. We actually get the $530 from you, where we could be spending that $530 on someone else.
I'm just going to jump in here to expand on what some of you may be thinking already. the injustice experienced by Kim is an echo of want throughout the system. Small private practices are losing money when they bulk bill. The Medicare rebate alone just isn't enough to cover the costs of medical indemnity premiums, rent, and staff wages. No wonder that specialty services aren't that viable in outer regional areas. As much as a practice might want to enable access to patients that can't afford it, is it for them or the Commonwealth to subsidise this? Or is it the state's responsibility to plug gaps with more outreach from their base hospitals? There's a whole podcast to be done on funding models, but let's get back to the story.
Is it still a work in progress to get people to know what Marabinia is and that it referrals off? Like?
So there's some service providers that we don't know much about that we want to know more about the program. So we actually invite service providers to our meeting every 3 months.
We have gone out and networked with the GPs in the Bathurst area. Melissa came over, went and introduced ourselves, spoke about the program, took some pamphlets and showed them the new referral and what's expected, and I think it's helped heaps. Like, the referrals are coming through now correct, and if we have any trouble, we'll just ring back and say, well, you know, this isn't signed off or whatever, can you do that? You build up a relationship with certain workers, the nurses maybe, or the practice nurse.
In the whole Western Health PHN, am I right, there's about 405 GPs?
Yes, that would be correct. 405 over 110 different GP practices. And we have, up until the end of March, we've had referrals from at least 88 of those practices. So we're well over 80% of practices referring into our program, which, you know, indicates that it is understood and being utilised. So, yeah.
That's great news.
It's pretty good. Since we've been operating in November 2016, we've managed to set up over 760 suppliers, a multitude of different specialists and allied health dotted throughout New South Wales. But we also have some providers in Melbourne and Adelaide as well, because we're sort of border some of those communities, and there's the closest healthcare specialist is in those locations.
While Marabinia helps with the costs of seeing a specialist, there are other barriers too for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients. Back in episode 12, we heard how Yolnu people in Arnhem Land look at the hospital not so much as a place of healing, but somewhere you go to die. While the gap in worldviews isn't so stark for most Aboriginal families, there are many ways in which healthcare institutions give a systematic, if unintended, cold shoulder to Indigenous patients. A sign that this might be occurring in your setting could be the high rates of missed follow-ups or discharge against medical advice. Rates of self-discharge among hospitalised Indigenous Australians are 6 to 19 times higher than they are for the rest of the population. Surveyed patients say that it's because health services are impersonal and don't accommodate family obligations. Many remain wary given rude or racist treatment in the past. And the word shame often comes up when Aboriginal people talk about their interactions with mainstream society. It refers to the fear of being judged for not following protocol. You might have experienced something similar when travelling in a foreign country. You're at the bank and you don't understand which forms you need or why everyone is queuing in a certain way, but you're too embarrassed to ask. Well, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, this is happening in their own country. There's this assumed social curriculum that most of us take for granted. I can't recommend highly enough the lectures by US academic Robin DiAngelo on deconstructing white privilege, which I've linked to at the website. I like to think I've earned my progress through society, but just how much have I benefited from systems that discriminate along race or gender or class? Conversely, Aboriginal people are often held personally responsible for bringing financial hardship or ill health upon themselves, when the same systems may be holding them back. As the Marabinia women describe, this implicit prejudice can make Aboriginal clients cautious about how much they share with health professionals. I asked the team what non-Aboriginal providers could do to make their services more understanding. you'll hear from Melissa Flannery, Possum Swinton, Donna Jeffries, Desley Mason and Kim Leese.
Like, I know I've worked in a practice as Aboriginal health practitioner, and like, people find it hard if it's all mainstream services, not being, you know, see a familiar face where they feel comfortable, and that if they're waiting there with all these white people, they get up and leave, and there is shame and just uncomfortable. I think it's uncomfortable to sit there and you feel judged. There's a lot of judgment, especially in small towns. If, you know, someone knows one family member did something wrong, they think everyone else did it, and a lot of judgment, I reckon.
Some people, I think, a lot of Aboriginal people feel inferior, and that's where our service is great, because we don't just transport that the client or the patient who needs help. We encourage them to have one support person go with them. So I think that makes a big difference, because two sets of ears are better than one, and it's just having that support and not feeling alone in a waiting room, as you say, in amongst everybody else. And I had a gentleman, he was born in Gadooga and lived there, and in his adult years he relocated to another community that you could access services better, but not having any sort of support for that. He wasn't getting to appointments and things because he couldn't afford it. His health was suffering, so he relocated back to Gadooga, and his niece said, you know, it made significant difference to his health because of that service that we'd provided for him, so which is pretty good.
Yeah, so even though it was a bit further, just the fact that he had a safety net there.
Yeah, you know, his health has improved since then, so, yeah, which is great.
When you're working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, a lot of the times people are on guard. And I think as part of a team, many of us that are sitting around this table, in the area that we operate, we all have really good, strong community networks and family networks. As soon as people can start joining the dots, the barriers and the walls seem to go down, and people are more likely to engage. They're more likely to share their experiences, whether they're good or bad, with you, and it's like a trust is formed.
Or sometimes if you've got an Aboriginal health worker, the Aboriginal health worker can explain to the patient what's happening, because sometimes jargon is a big thing with Aboriginal people, especially elders, don't understand it.
Yeah, and there was a study in the Medical Journal of Australia that showed how there was a direct link between the number of Aboriginal health workers per population and their adherence to diabetes services, how many appointments they went to, and how, you know, when you guys are calling up the various clinics and making appointments, are there some clinics that you prefer to call up because they're easier to deal with, they understand culture better, or do you have a blacklist or whatever, or does it just depend on who's nearest by? Or
I've had a client report back to me. She was a Christian lady. Her and her husband were down in Sydney, and she has really severe respiratory disease. And her husband was getting quite angry because the healthcare professionals come in and they'd say, look, we know you're from Brewarrina. Now you just need to tell us how many drinks and how many smokes you have. And these people, like, they've been Christians for years. I've never known either of them to drink or smoke or anything. It's just really condescending. And that's can be typical of some of the stories that get fed back to us. Because blackfellas are not shy in coming forward. If they have a bad experience, they'll let us know, and particularly because we're all Indigenous as well. And, you know, we'll be aware of it. If it happens more than once, well, then I'll contact the practice or the service provider or whoever it is. And so hopefully, you know, we're providing that little bit of not cultural awareness training, but we will highlight and we'll bring to the attention if some of our clients have had a bad experience. So, Yeah, I wouldn't call it a blacklist or a white list or whatever, but
that's the wrong words anyway.
Yeah, if there's been a bad experience, we'll definitely find out about it.
Experiencing it personally myself. Of course, I've got issues with my liver, some kind of, it's a fatty liver, and that, and they say, are you a heavy drinker? And I said, sorry, sir, I don't drink. My last drink was 30 years ago. I never was a heavy drinker at all. It might have been once a month, and that's what they assumed it was. I was a full-blown alcoholic. And that's the hurtful part of it.
Mm. And I think another thing to get through to specialists and that too is how isolated some of our communities are, how much harder it is for them to get to these appointments. So if they can try to ensure that they, you know, if they've got an appointment, not to change it. You know, sometimes I know it can't be helped, but can you really look at where that person's coming from and what it's taken for them to get to where they need that help? If you're going to have to change anybody or put anybody back on the list, can it be somebody who can access it more easily than our clients?
Well, you have like a hospital that puts a client sitting there waiting for surgery. Hospital will say, no, we're not going to operate today. We're going to operate tomorrow. Comes that day, they put it back again. They put it off. We supported someone down there for about a month, yeah, waiting for surgery. It was about $2,000 for a week that we were supporting them to stay down there. And it's very frustrating because they're away from home, they're away from family, but you can't go home because if he did go home, he'd be put back for another year for an operation.
What do you do? Yeah.
Because a lot of the people from out at Woomeringle and Gadooga, they don't have public transport, and that, so they rely on family members, you know, to get them to and from appointments.
And a family member that's come along has given up a day of work to
that is correct.
You can't always guarantee they're going to be able to take you again later on. So, but even though we've supplied them with accommodation, that they've got to buy food on top of that, and it's, you know, you're thinking it's not cheap. You've still got to have meals and things and.
And what's it like to go into the big smoke for all of these clients?
Scary for me. I drive there, no way.
And I, one client and that that lives in Dubbo, she won't go to Sydney by herself because she's terrified. Mm-hmm. She's terrified of getting off the train and if something's going to happen, or terrified of getting lost. Mm. A lot of Aboriginal people, and I'm one of them, don't know how to catch buses and trains in Sydney.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
You need an Opal card first.
Yeah. Well, if you say Opal card to me, I'd look for Lightning Ridge to go look for an Opal. See?
Yeah.
So if you say to someone, oh, you need an Opal card, what is that? You know, where do I get it from? And one good thing with Murrumbinya is that, and a lot of them love it, is cab vouchers.
Another excellent service that works in with us is Country Care Link, where they'll, if you can give them 48 hours notice, it's a volunteer group run by Sisters of Charity, and they'll organise somebody to meet you at the train or the plane and take you to your accommodation, and they've said they couldn't be more helpful. And it costs nothing, and it's for country people, not just Aboriginal people, but for all country people. And it's great to have resources that you can work together with that can help us out as well, because that saves on our funding a little too. So, and it just makes the trip a little more comfortable for them.
Just one thing that that would be helpful for specialists and GPs and people that work with Indigenous people is to just not be afraid, like we're people like everybody else, so just treat us like everybody else and leave all the assumptions and any prejudgments or whatever at the door, and just treat us as you would your mother, your brother, your sister, your father, whatever. So that would be a big hint from me.
I know one of the accommodations down here, because mines come from condo down here sometimes for treatment, and one of the accommodations down here. They love it. He goes out and sits out with the clients and have a cup of coffee with them and everything, and they just love going to the Atlas down here.
The Western New South Wales Primary Health Network that Maribyrnong falls in is one of 38 PHNs across the country that were established to respond to the specific needs of each locality. But this specific model for investing Commonwealth integrated team care funding is unique in design and in its effectiveness. Every community is different, and one of the principles of the RACP's Medical Specialist Access Framework is that models of care need to be context dependent. But first and foremost, services for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will thrive best where community leadership is included in the design and delivery. Maribyrnong is an exemplary case study of these principles. To bid for the government contract, Donna Jeffries and her colleagues brought together established and respected providers of Aboriginal health services, namely Māori Mā in Bourke and Bila Mūji in Dubbo. Their proposal was considered unfeasible at first, but Donna describes how the business case was made and how Maribyrnong has earned a new round of funding to continue to reach more people.
For a number of years prior to the PHNs, a lot of the funding was actually being spent on care coordination. So it was up to 70-80% of the money that was allocated for the program was actually spent on wages, program running costs, office space, vehicles, and that sort of thing. And they wanted to try things differently, give it to an Aboriginal corporation to basically put Aboriginal health into Aboriginal hands, which is what you have with Maribyrnong. And the way that we operate, we have a 50-50 split, 50-50 commitment, so 50% of our annual budget will be spent on staff and program costs, and 50% of our budget is put towards clients' supplementary services. Another way that we were able to really save on setup costs and things for a brand new program was to actually use the infrastructure that's already available in communities. Like, where we could, we've co-located with Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations such as Outback Division of General Practice out in Bourke. So these organisations, they already have offices, they already have desks, they have chairs, they have telephones. All we needed were new employees, a mobile phone and a laptop and a good database to collect all of our information and track our services. So to set the program up, doesn't take rocket science. We've worked really hard to keep it simple, and the benefits of that is that we can sit and easily talk about the program and explain it to our potential clients, but also to our healthcare partners across the region. So it's been quite remarkable. We started with 600 clients in November 2016, and up until the end of last December, December 2018, we'd serviced over 5,050 people. So we average every 3 months between 950 and 1,000 new referrals, and we're organising up to 5,500, almost 6,000 support services for those referrals that we get.
Wow. In terms of measures that you can collect through all of the usual, you know, health system, do you think it will be possible to measure that impact in terms of disease and well-being, or is it too hard?
I think over time, over, you know, the coming years, we'll be able to get a more accurate measure of people's healthcare status. I know there's anecdotal evidence there that people are actually getting better because of Maribyrnong. There was a lady back in our, when we first started, I think she's a client of Dubbo Aboriginal Medical Service, and she was on the public guy health screening agenda, but she required these specific injections every 2 weeks, but the public clinic was only available every 6 weeks. Anyway, the GP thought, well, we'll refer to Maribyrnong and we'll see. And we said, of course, we can step in and send her off to a private provider. And, you know, the feedback we got from her GP was that it saved her sight. And because of that, she was able to continue working. And, you know, she still had a quality of life and was able to contribute looking after her family. So, you know, it's sort of the work that we're doing, it provides not only healing our mob, but it's also we're able to contribute to back to the whole community through a program such as this. It's the only one of its type in Australia, but really there's absolutely no reason that a program like this could not expand further or even be Australia-wide.
Many thanks to all the staff at Maribyrnya for contributing to this episode of Pomegranate Health. The names are Donna Jeffries, Desley Mason, Sandra Ritchie, Possum Swinton, Jake Bloomfield, Joanne and Gabby Bug, and Melissa Flannery. Invaluable feedback came from Masita Ma, who leads the RACP's Aboriginal initiatives, and Uncle Terry Williams from our Consumer Advisory Group. And as always, thanks to the tireless members of the podcast editorial group. Please go to racp.edu.au/podcast to see how the Medical Specialist Access Framework can guide more equitable delivery of care to Indigenous patients. There are several inspiring case studies from around the country and from different healthcare settings. At the website, there are also links to e-learning courses on cultural safety and also those lectures I mentioned earlier. If you like the show, please tell a friend how they can subscribe to Pomegranate Health. Any podcasting app will do. Or there's also an emails alert list for the late adopters. Finally, it's worth reflecting that the 170-year-old sandstone building that houses the RACP stands on land the traditional custodians called Kadi. The Kadi people, or Kadigal, were almost completely wiped out by a smallpox outbreak in the year after colonisation. This podcast acknowledges the wealth of knowledge that has been lost, but also the thriving culture being passed on by elders past and present. The RACP supports medical graduates and trainees identifying as Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander or Māori to undertake physician training. There have been 20 recipients of the scholarship since it started in 2015. That's all for now. I'm Mika Cavazzini.